Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game, with me, Kevin Day, and him, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. I'm speaking a little bit quicker than usual in case more news breaks while we're on air, because Kieran, old chum, we've been told this before in our lives, but boy, we timed that wrong, didn't we?
Well, we got it really screwed up, didn't we?
Just as we finished recording on Sunday, you said you had a tweet coming through about an impending European Super League announcement. So we then spent 3 days preparing a special podcast, trying to phone Gary Neville, and blimey, the bloody thing's almost over. Everyone's walking away whistling with their hands in their pockets, pretending nothing happened. 48 questions I had for you, Kieran. 48.
Oh, now, Jesus.
I know. And seriously, now I've got one, and it's basically what just happened. It's, thank God Southampton have signed a new kit deal. We'd have nothing to talk about.
Exactly.
Later, we'll be hearing from Matt Slater, top football news reporter at The Athletic, to get his thoughts on the Super League and some other stuff too. I'll just pause here to cross out, and some other stuff too. He was very optimistic and producing writer. And the first part. Seriously, I'm not asking Matt Slater about Southampton's new kit deal. So, Kieran, we've lived through a bit of football history, quite possibly the most significant moment for our game in a long time, the moment when a whole country discovered who the game really belongs to, a moment when some very greedy people realised that the desperate pursuit of even more money isn't what football is about, when they realised that you can appeal to as many overseas fans as you like, but there's only so far you can take the piss out of the fans on your own doorstep, and a moment when those fans, Kieran, I think, realised that actually not all Premier League players are greedy, money-grabbing bastards, and that together we can actually make a difference. So let's talk about what happened. Obviously, some of these subjects may overlap with what we talked to Matt about, but let's see if we can unpick what happened. And I should point out, listeners, that we are recording this at 11:30 p.m. on Wednesday night, and I still can't guarantee that we'll be up to date with all this. The first question, Kieran, you've been predicting this ever since we started the pod back in October 2019. Why was it suddenly announced on Monday? Was it to preempt the Champions League announcement? Was it because the grounds are still empty? Or was it just to make more money as quickly as possible and use COVID as the excuse?
I think we've got different parties with different motives. So I think we've got to start, first of all, with the American owners of English clubs. In particular there, we're looking at Liverpool, Manchester United and Arsenal. They come from a different culture. They come from a sporting viewpoint that clubs are franchisees, and they're familiar with the sealed units, and that works for everybody. You know, the fans accept it. You know, you don't see fans moaning in the NFL or the MLB because they know that their team is going to be in that division next year, and there is no effective second tier. The players accept it because they tend to be very well paid. The broadcasters love it because it delivers. If you take a look at United States viewing figures, I think it was 18 of the top 20 viewing attendances or viewing figures in the US in 2020 or 2019 were to do with live sport. So they're happy, and then we've got the franchise owners. And because they share revenues equally and they have wage caps, it's actually very profitable, very lucrative. And if you want to buy, even if you want to go and buy the worst team in the NFL, it will cost you $2.5 billion. Mm. Now, if we contrast that with the Premier League, you would struggle to get $2 billion for more than three or four clubs. So, you know, from their perspective, how can we get rid of the problem? And the problem, as far as the owners are concerned, is they've got this thing called relegation, and they've also got the issue of if they want to play in European football at the Champions League, they need to win football matches. They need to finish in the top four. And this really came to fruition in 2016 when Leicester City, through being the best football team in the country, won the Premier League and therefore took away one of the Champions League places, which these clubs consider to be theirs by right. So since then, they have been working on an alternative to qualifying for the Champions League. And what we've seen is the manifestation of that, because their aims is to maximise profits. Now, that's not all of the six clubs that we're talking about. Chelsea and Manchester City are completely different. Chelsea is Roman Abramovich's toy. He acquired the club in, was it 2003? And he loves the fans, and the fans love him. Yeah, they've got a, he's got a genuine affection for the club. He wants it to succeed. And he saw his legacy last night being destroyed through not, it wasn't his idea. You know, they, City and Chelsea, they could have taken or, take or leave this franchise league. But what Abramovich didn't want to do is to waste 20 years of a loving with Chelsea fans. So he effectively saw the fans protesting, made the decision. He was wavering beforehand, and that sealed the deal. City, exactly the same. You know, why irritate your own fan base when you've got so much money that you can underwrite all the losses as the Manchester City owners have done over the course of the last decade? So as soon as Chelsea did it, City had been wavering as well. They pulled out, and then the whole thing went down like a pack of cards. So that's what we've got here in England. And then you move to the continent, you've got AC Milan, who are owned by what is referred to a vulture fund. A vulture fund takes on distressed companies and just tries to get as many bucks out of them as possible. So AC Milan did it because they've got owners, and vulture funds have these guys. I think they took on the government of Argentina a few years ago, and they beat the government of Argentina. Yeah, we're talking about people who have no moral or ethical compass. They have no sense of romance. They are not football fans. And in other businesses, you say, yeah, we see that exists. We don't actually care. But football is our game. It is, you know, it is the romantic in us all. So that's the position that we saw in Italy to a certain extent. We've got Agnelli at Juventus, who was head of the European Club Association. So therefore, in theory, he is responsible towards the 250 clubs in the ECA. At the same time, he was negotiating on behalf of these other 12 clubs, because Juventus, what's happened to them in the last 3 years? They've been knocked out of the Champions League by Lyon, Porto and Ajax. He's also said that Atalanta should not qualify for the Champions League because they don't have history and heritage. Okay. And history and heritage is really important to somebody who is an inherited billionaire. Because So that's Italy. We then move to Spain. And when you take a look at the balance sheets of both Real Madrid and Barcelona, they are looking very distressed. They owe an awful lot of debt. They generate huge sums of money through match day, through people doing the tours of the stadium, through the museum, through hospitality. They don't have the benefits of the TV deals on a proportionate basis necessary to the same extent as we have in the UK. And because they are member-owned clubs, they can't go to the owners and say, we need 100 million quid. Yeah, could you sub us? So we've got different parties with different motivations. And in the background, they've been using the Super League as a bargaining chip against UEFA for the last 20 to 30 years. And it's worked every time. I think this time, for a combination of reasons, they didn't manage to extract the concessions that they were looking from UEFA in terms of certainty of qualifying for the tournament. But the big issue was the ability to sell TV rights. If you actually take a look at the small print of this proposed deal, it's two groups of 10, so therefore you've got 9 home fixtures each, and you're able to sell 3 of the sets of rights yourself. Mm. Plug in the numbers. Sorry.
Sorry, Ken. We talked specifically about the clubs, Man City and Chelsea in particular, with Matt Slater, and I still find it hard to believe that Man City and Chelsea are spinning this. We had to join because we'd be left behind. The same with Arsenal and Tottenham, but Matt was very eloquent on that. And I think, to be fair to some American club owners, Burnley read the room much better than Man United, for example, because the Burnley's owners came out very strongly against this and said, you have to understand the culture you're in. The TV deal is not something most people did. Was the TV deal already in place, or did they just expect a major bidding war when this happened?
They had put out tentative feelers, but nothing had been signed. But I think they were confident because they know from experience that if you are a subscription broadcaster, the one thing that stops people from cutting the cord is sports rights to big competitions. Hmm. And they felt that by having this, and as it's an American franchise league, this roster of clubs who are going to be in it every year, they would be able to go to both European broadcasters, American broadcasters, Asian broadcasters, and to a certain extent, name their price. So they felt very confident. In terms of their own rights, and I think this was really important to the Glazers and Ed Woodward, Manchester United have 1 billion fans, according to their PR agency. Yeah, now, yeah. I take that with a pinch of salt. You know, it's because sometimes if you sent, you know, I get surveys, you get surveys coming through the internet, and you say, well, you know, which NFL team do you support? And you're given a list of 12, and I go, oh, well, it's the, yeah, you know, the San Francisco Hippos or whatever it is.
It's the Philadelphia Eagles here. I mean, you should surely guess which NFL team we support.
So they've got, in theory, 1 billion fans. Mm. Now, if they've got... Now, Manchester United make £250 million a year from TV rights from the Premier League and UEFA. Let's now do the maths. If you get 5% of your fans to pay £5 each, it's 50 million people at a fiver each from one game of football, you've got £250 million. And the Glazers and Ed Woodward are convinced that they can do it. So for them, it's a no-brainer. And from a balance sheet, from a finance point of view, this could make an awful lot of sense, but it completely detaches from the culture of football that you first encountered when you first started playing, you know, kids football at the age of 9 or 10, that if you won a few matches, you won a cup final, or you got promoted to the next division. And even when we were playing Sunday league football, you know, again, we, you know, if you weren't too rat-arsed after the previous Saturday night and you had a good team and a good squad, you go up a couple of divisions. And that applies to all level of football. And I've just seen a tweet by Kevin De Bruyne, and he says, yes, I am in a privileged position. I am a professional athlete. Yes, it is a business. But I've grown up with football as a form of competition, and this is not competition.
Mm. I should point out, Kieran, to quite a few of our listeners who listen to the pod driving to work, that they may have to drive around the block a couple of times before they get into the office, because this is shaping up to be a long pod, Kieran. Because we've still got quite a lot to cover. One thing that's bothering me, well, no, there's 48 things that are bothering me, Kieran. How is this going to play out legally with JP Morgan? I can't remember whether I'm saying JP Morgan or Morgan Stanley. What am I saying, Kieran?
No, JP Morgan. They're different. JP Morgan Chase, yeah, is the official name. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Okay. At one stage in a different pod, I said Morgan's Rum, which was definitely wrong, wasn't it? surely there's some form already of contractual arrangement with JP Morgan. We've heard some of the eye-watering sums that they're supposed to be putting up for this, and now the clubs have clearly broken that contract. Will JP Morgan not be looking for financial compensation, or is that not how it works?
Well, without seeing the contract, we can't say with certainty, right. But you know, JP Morgan's employees will have been working on this project. As far as they were concerned, the project was announced on Sunday night, and therefore they've put a lot of hours in. They're entitled to form some form of recompense. They were due to be lending these clubs, was it $3.5 billion? Yeah. Looking at how much they were due to be repaid, $260 million a year. Yeah, they've lost out. So, you know, depending upon the nature of the contracts, they will be talking to their silver tongue friends. Mm. And I suspect some form of recompense will be required because, as far as they're concerned, they've done the work. They put together the package of funding. And now, beyond the 11th hour, people have walked away. And remember, if we take a look at the comments which have come from the football clubs, is that we have withdrawn yes. from the European Super or the Super League project yes. because it does appear that it was going to be some form of global franchise arrangement.
Yeah, because it was quite plain from when Sky were breaking the news last night about Man City and Chelsea that they were talking about putting into place the paperwork to negotiate a withdrawal. So clearly that was already part of a contractual thing anyway, because they said they it wasn't just a verbal thing, we're pulling out. They had to put paperwork into place. Now, Kieran, oddly enough, we spoke for the first time last week about special purpose acquisition companies, didn't we, in America?
We did, yes.
And one economist on Newsnight this week suggested this may have been a giant JP Morgan SPAC. Could that be true?
I don't think so, because the nature of an SPAC is that you do not know the company which you're actually going to buy and which you're then going to list.
Right.
So I'm not convinced about it, because clearly we do have the identity and there's no evidence. Manchester United and Juventus are already traded on the stock exchanges, and those are two of the most valuable brands in the 12. I couldn't really see why Roman Abramovich would want Chelsea shares being quoted or even linked to a stock exchange, because it's his little fiefdom. It's exactly the same with Mansour in respect of Manchester City. They like the independence. They like the fact that they can make decisions quickly, a quick couple of phone calls and things automatically go through. That's the advantage of having one person in charge. I've said on many occasions that the benevolent dictator for me is the perfect model in terms of football ownership, because you've got A, somebody that's got funding, and B, they're answerable to nobody, provided they've got the long-term interest or the short-term interest of the club at heart, then things can really whiz through.
Mention of the stock market brings me to my next question, funny enough, because how did they manage to keep this so quiet, Kieran? Because as Graham Souness said several times, because once he's got an idea in his head, he likes to rattle it around until we've all heard it. But to me, this made perfect sense. He said if the clubs listed on the stock market, Man United in particular, would surely have to have made shareholders aware of this before the decision was made, wouldn't they?
No, you announce things to the stock market usually if they have a significant impact on the club. So normally, having signed a contract with, for example, a new sponsor, then Manchester United would make a release to the stock exchange when they announce their results, when they have a fresh issue of shares. It's always on the after side of the decision. So they were, under normal circumstances, we would have expected them to make some announcement to the New York Stock Exchange. But what was intriguing was that the story broke clearly at midnight European time, or 11 p.m. Local time for us. And what we saw in the pre-markets in New York was a big bounce for the shares of Manchester United. The shares of Juve went up by 10 or 11%. And by the time we got to Monday night, and remember Monday night, and we still thought this was all going full steam ahead.
Yeah.
The value of Manchester United's shares had increased by $250 million. As soon as things started to reverse on the Tuesday, that $250 million was wiped off the market instantly. So if somebody did have wind of this in advance, you could have a bit of insider dealing. So, you know, Manchester United actually have an obligation to keep it really sealed, because if people, you know, if one or two people were aware that this was going to go ahead, they could have bought the shares on the Friday night and then, you know, ridden that particular wave and made a profit in just a few hours on the Monday. So they had to keep it quiet. And I think that's part of the justification that the club will claim in respect of not telling the managers, not telling the other employees, and everything was so tight-lipped, because they'll say, well, we've got an obligation to our shareholders and also market protocols and market conduct.
Well, you'd be a bit cross, wouldn't you, if you were Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and they said, well, we couldn't tell you in case you went and made a few bob on the stock market. But
yeah.
I mean, it was interesting, is that because we spoke after the pod, Kieran, because we did talk at one stage of maybe recording an emergency pod that night, but decided that we should probably wait and see what happened first before, because it would have been terrible if we'd done an emergency pod on Sunday to put out on Monday, because we would have been so far behind the curve. But the only moment I thought this would genuinely happen was when it was announced that Man United's stock market value had gone up by $250 million, because then you think, well, they will suck up any abuse the fans take for as long as they want if they're making that money that quickly. So it almost made their capitulation even more remarkable when it was quite clear how much was there to be made out of this, wasn't it?
Yes, and I think that £250 million was also the market factoring at the time. This is not 100%, because some people were still saying that potentially this is a bargaining chip, because for the last 20 to 30 years, these clubs and others have been trying to blackmail UEFA into extracting more and more concessions. And they've actually still won, because they've got all of the concessions they were looking for from UEFA. In terms of greater involvement in broadcasting and commercial deals,
yeah.
And the use of the UEFA coefficient to award two of the additional places in the Champions League, which that these things tend to become self-fulfilling, that if you get into the Champions League once or twice, it makes such an impact to your coefficient that we could see the Premier League contributing six teams to the Champions League practically every year, provided they finish, I think they'd have to finish in the top seven of the Premier League, but that they'll automatically get in. And it could mean, of course, that you could have somebody finishing fifth, you know, West Ham or Leicester, and the sides below them do qualify. This is what Agnelli has been preaching about for years, that clubs should be allowed to compete in the competition on the basis of their history, rather than winning football matches this season.
Yeah. Quite a few things, Kieran, went under the radar. Don't worry, Southampton fans, not your new kit deal. We spotted that. But Florentino Perez at Real Madrid, for example, suggesting that matches in the Super League will only be 70 minutes long, because young people's attention spans are shorter now. But the one for me that stands out as not really being covered at all is the fact that women's teams were included in this without any consultation at all, which was shameful. And Nadine Kessler, who's the UEFA boss of women's football, said that an ESL for women will devastate the game. How could they possibly drag the women into this at a time, Kieran, especially in England, when we've talked so optimistically about the new broadcasting deal? And not only that, the Liverpool women have just been relegated. It just beggars belief, the arrogance here, doesn't it?
Well, I think they'd written the press release, they'd done all their plan. There was no plans for a women's European Super League.
Right. And then they
looked at it and then they said, hold on, we've got women's teams as well. Let's just stick in an extra line and we'll sort it out in 2 or 3 years' time as we get closer to the launch of the competition. So there was no serious consideration. There were no budgets. There were no calculations. It was, this is going to look really silly if we've got Manchester United and Barcelona and Juventus's men's team playing in their own little competition and you've got the Manchester United women's team playing in a UEFA sanctioned competition. That just looked so crazy that they said, "Oh no, we just lob the women in as well." And the thing which I found sort of fascinating on Monday, in respect of the people that were making these decisions, that none of them were prepared to come and talk on television, and that's why I think their complete contempt for the club manager, in the sense that Solskjaer and Klopp and Guardiola were effectively thrown under the bus. They had to go and face the press, and you could see the annoyance, because there was no consultation in terms of, you know, had the managers been briefed? Were they given, they weren't given any advance warning, and they weren't told any of the advantages. And financially, there are advantages to those 12 clubs. There's financial disadvantages for practically everybody else. But it was sort of heartening. And I think that's when the ball started to roll against the franchisees. As we heard Klopp's comments, and then James Milner came out, and then Jordan Henderson, and Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher, everybody who loves football who's got a Sky subscription was watching Monday night when they just let rip. And Gary Neville's a United fan, but by his own admission, he'd kept his gob shut during the initial years of the Glazer reign, and now he says, they fooled me. They've made a mug of me, and I teach at the University of Liverpool. I had my mates who I share an office with saying, I hate to say this, but God bless Gary Neville. And I think he sort of galvanized fans who sort of said, well, we actually agree entirely with what he said. Mm. That sort of manifested itself in the protests at Stamford Bridge. Abramovich was wavering, and as soon as he saw 3,000 angry men outside Stamford Bridge, he was thinking, why am I doing this? I didn't buy Chelsea Football Club to get this type of abuse, given that I've all I've done for the club. And I'm not particularly asked about the competition. How can I win back favour? And benevolent dictator, he can make that decision in 30 seconds flat. The word goes out, and then we're on a roll.
See, Roman Abramovich doesn't go back as far as we do, Kieran, so he won't be used to seeing 3,000 angry men outside Stamford Bridge in the way that we are. It's almost like we're simpatico tonight, Kieran. Our married life is back on track because we're thinking along the same lines. Because talking of television, and Gary Neville, I was very impressed by him last night on a Zoom call when he was in front of a picture of Che Guevara, which is clearly his statement.
I thought it was Jimi Hendrix.
No, it's Hendrix was on one side and Che Guevara on the other, I believe.
And then he had those strange words. I thought he was in a crack den. Lordy.
It was a Banksy he was hiding as well.
Possibly
a real one, knowing Gary Neville.
Yes.
But also, I mean, Jamie Carragher's was enormous credit. Basically, at one stage on Monday night, said to the Sky presenter, well, you can wipe the smile off your face because you started it. Is this, it's you that broke football for the Premier League, so let's not get too above ourselves, which is good. But I've been very proud, I have to say, as a Palace fan, of Steve Parish, chairman of Crystal Palace. Now, and I don't know whether he's a self-appointed spokesman for the other 14 clubs or whether they've asked him to do so, but, I mean, he's been everywhere. Basically, he's been the Kieran Maguire of club chairman, essentially. You can't turn the telly on without him popping up, but also not plugging his own book shamelessly in the background, Kieran. But he referred to what he said, this abhorrent plan. He was very good when Emily Maitlis on Newsnight said to him, well, you would be against it if your club was in the top six. You'd be all for it. And he said, no, I wouldn't. If there's every chance that Palace could be in League Two in three seasons' time, and I would have to suck it up because that's what football's about. But he asked a question, Kieran, which is rhetorical, but I want you to tell me whether there's an answer to it. And basically he said, how much more, and I'm quoting, how much more money do these clubs want or need? Is there an answer to that question?
In terms of want, it's limitless. At present, I did the sums. The average revenue of let's call them the big six, the greedy six. The average revenue of one of those clubs in the Premier League is £500 million a year, exactly. And the average revenue of the other 14 is 154. So they have three times the revenue of the other teams. But when you break it down, in terms of commercial income, they've actually got 80% of the total commercial income split between six teams. Wow. And in terms of the TV income, it worked out as about 45. John Henry and Joel Glazer genuinely believe that they are the victims in all of this.
What?
Because they are only getting an extra £100 million a year from TV money. And in their minds, the only reason why people tune in to watch television in terms of football is to watch their teams. Now, that is not the case. There is no doubt that they generate the biggest audiences. And on the back of that, they do get an extra, you know, they would get an extra £150 million a year compared to the clubs such as Bournemouth and Watford and Burnley. And they say, well, an extra £150 million isn't enough because they have come into football late. They don't recall that if you take a look at the Premier League in its very first season, 1992-93, yes, Manchester United won it, but then if you take a look at the positions of Arsenal and Spurs and City and Liverpool, they were all mid-table. Yeah, there wasn't a big six because I think the runners-up were Villa and Blackburn potentially were third that season. I can't quite remember. So this concept of the big six has only really been around in the last 7 or 8 years, but somehow it's become embedded into our psyche that they've always been the big six clubs. Yeah, but you know, big six clubs normally have to win something, so that instantly rules out Spurs.
Yeah, absolutely. It was interesting, Graham Souness and Jamie Carragher both insisting last night that John Henry had damaged the reputation of the Liverpool Football Club to such an extent that the only way out of it for him was to sell it. That seems unlikely.
John Henry has damaged the reputation of John Henry,
right,
but he won't care because if you are a very successful commodities trader, and that's what you are, you're used to a fairly tough environment. And also, he's living in Boston, so he's not actually feeling the degree of hostility. John Henry is a remarkably intelligent, analytical individual, and if you're in a room with him, people will say, yeah, he's not a great conversationalist, but you start talking business and blimey O'Reilly, this guy is really, really smart. And you know, that's why his young and very attractive wife decided to marry the 71-year-old billionaire commodities trader. It wasn't for his ability to remember the lyrics of You'll Never Walk Alone.
So are you implying, Kieran, that she was attracted to the fact he knows his way around a spreadsheet?
Exactly. Yeah. Why do women fall for me? You know, I whip out my spreadsheet in a Moscow nightclub, Kevin, and it's like honey's round a pot.
It's clear, though, don't they? I've got my hay fever started. So don't even know. It's clear, though, that United are very worried about rebuilding bridges. I mean, the statement this evening from Joel Glazer, the open letter, which went on for quite some time, was almost more abject than Arsenal's apology. So clearly that somebody's whispered in their ear that they may have done some damage to the brand. But I'm aware that time's getting on, Kieran, and we've got that brilliant interview with Matt Slater to talk about. So there are one or two things I still want to talk to you about. We do have a couple of other news stories, oddly enough, which I think we will rattle through.
Yes, because I've not researched them.
Nor have I. I've only just written them down, to be perfectly honest, as I thought Guy was joking when he said we had to talk about them. Genuinely thought he was joking when we thought I had to talk about them. The Premier League were very swift. I mean, it was within an hour on Sunday to issue a statement in response to this, Kieran, and it mentions just about every group in football, LMA, FSA, PFA. You're a big fan of Line of Duty, Kieran, so I know you love an acronym. But the EFL were not included, which led to quite the speculation and conspiracy theories. Any thoughts on that, Kieran? Because, the biggest conspiracy theory was that Rick Parry was only too willing and welcome to offer the Big Six a place in the Championship if anything went tits up.
Well, this came out on the basis of when Project Big Picture was around. And if you remember, Rick Parry was, again, the clubs themselves just ducked and dived, and they threw Rick Parry under the bus. So he had to go onto BBC TV, and he was saying Liverpool and Manchester United are great clubs and they care about the whole pyramid of football, and this is fantastic news. So he's been made to look daft by these people, because clearly they were plotting this project without his knowledge at the time. And one of the stories which was doing the rounds in the press at the time was that because he was in favour of Project Big Picture, if the other 14 clubs had kicked the Big Six out or forced them to resign, then the EFL was willing to accommodate them because the EFL needed money. And all of a sudden, you've got a championship which features Liverpool, Chelsea, Manchester United, and Derby, Sheffield Wednesday, Forest, so on and so forth. So, probably out of necessity, even if it was just going to be for one season, then you could see the benefits to the EFL. And could the same thing apply here? The EFL didn't put out a statement until 4 p.m. on the Monday, which, they were a bit slow to react. Now, they might have said, well, this isn't our fight. We're not getting involved. We don't know what had been happening. And the one thing we know about the internet is the internet loves a vacuum. So given that the story had been doing the rounds in the newspapers 6 months previously about the EFL being willing to accommodate these clubs, then you can see why people thought, well, it might happen again.
Yeah, it wasn't a good look for the EFL that Boris Johnson was more outspoken on the subject than they were for a good 12 hours. But just a couple more things, Kieran. Jonathan Barnett, super agent, Gareth Bale being one of his clients, said that he would take any attempt by FIFA or UEFA to sanction players, i.e. to stop them playing for their countries, to the highest court in the land. Presumably, obviously that won't happen, but the legal profession, I imagine, are going to be making a lot of money out of this for quite some time to come, aren't they?
Well, yes. I think there will be consequences. Jonathan Barnett has got a responsibility to protect his players' interests. I think he might have struggled a little bit because, remember, we have seen the England rugby union team say that if players decide to play their domestic game in France where there is not a wage cap, then by all means go off. So, but by the way, don't expect to be chosen to play for the England team. And on the basis of that, you make your decisions. And by all means that we hear that Harry Maguire confronted Ed Woodward on Monday with regards to exactly this issue. You've gone and joined this. You've joined this organisation without getting any guarantees that I can maintain my England career. And playing for England is the highest honour in the country as far as a footballer is concerned. And yes, Harry Maguire earns a lot of money from Manchester United, but what would he want more than anything else? A World Cup winner's medal. The same goes for Harry Kane. The same goes for Marcus Rashford. When you are 7 years old and you're running around in your shorts in the school playing ground, what are you dreaming of doing? It's not scoring the goal that wins the franchise cup in 2023.
I actually, to be honest, Kieran, I found it quite refreshing. I'm quite uplifting that football players, these highly paid, greedy bastard Premier League football players that we're told so much about from across the globe were furious at the idea that they may not be able to play for their countries, because it ends that cliche now that players don't, but it's not important to them, because clearly it still is. Talking of, I'm going to go through it, Kieran, because people will wonder why I said talking of and then stopped. It's because I have no confidence in this next link, which I'm improvising. Talking of countries, Kieran, given the German ownership model, it's perhaps not surprising that Bayern and Dortmund refused to join, but I would have expected PSG to be involved.
Well, let's do a crumb trail. Who owns PSG? It's QSI, the Qatari Investment Authority. What's happening in Qatar in 2022? There's a World Cup taking place. There's a World Cup that is taking place, which has a tainted reputation.
Yeah.
So here's an opportunity for PSG to come out of this, and therefore indirectly Qatar to come out of this, smelling of roses. We stood up to the Dirty Dozen we like the idea of the integrity of football. And also, of course, they don't need the money because they've got the backing of a sovereign wealth fund. So Qatar is desperate to generate more positive vibes by hosting the 2022 World Cup. We know that the awarding of the tournament was due to unusual events in exactly the same way that arose in respect of Russia. And, you know, what was the perception of the World Cup in Russia? It was a success. Why was it a success as far as we're concerned? England got to the semi-final. So, you know, the Qatari decision makers will have said, well, you know, we can avoid getting a double whammy of criticism by simply not agreeing to turn up in this tournament, because we know where the weight of public opinion will be. I think nobody quite expected such a universal reaction in terms of cross-party politics. Okay, some of that could be on the back of populism. Players, managers, ex-players, pundits, even in my profession, I've only got one or two academics sort of saying, well, actually, it could be a good idea. But, you know, it's 99% of people. But it's, you know, I think YouGov did a survey and they said only 80% of fans of the big six clubs were against the competition. I'm going, well, I'm buggered if I know who the other 20% are who are in favour of it, because they're not in this country, that's for sure. But then, hold on. If you're a Chinese Manchester United fan who fancies, you know, how they're going to engage with the club, it's going to be through watching the club on TV. And if now every season they are going to be playing Barcelona, Real Madrid, you know, but in an ideal world from their point of view, Bayern Munich and Liverpool, you'd think that's rather splendid, because who are these Burnley people? You know, West Bromwich Albion. So from a, you know, we look at it through the lens of growing up, falling in love with, you know, we've always said we growing up, falling in love with football at the age of 7 or 8, because we went along with a friend, an uncle, an auntie, your mum, your dad, doesn't matter who is. And we've always said the floodlights, the smell of the burgers, the green of the grass, the chanting, and that's it. You are hooked. Well, that's not the case for these fans. You know, they've done it because they've got FIFA 21 and Manchester United are a really good team on FIFA, so therefore they support Manchester United. And Manchester United have opened three virtual reality experiences in China. So, you know, it's an appeal to them. So you can see why the international fan base were going, well, we know all the fuss is about it.
One more question for you, Kieran, and it still won't be the end of it, obviously. Where does this leave the Champions League? Do we, you know, will they just simply accept the new model that was put through on Monday and it will carry on as it always did, but with the coefficient and the more money for the bigger clubs?
Yes, I think the bigger clubs have probably got 80 to 85% of what they wanted in terms of additional concessions from UEFA. And the Franchise League gave them 100% of what they wanted.
Yeah.
And if you're a blackmailer at some point in time, this has always been a blackmail option, you actually go the full hog. And that's what they decided to do, potentially for the reasons which I've mentioned above, that selling your own rights and financial necessity for the Spanish clubs decided to, you know, resulted in them going all in.
Yeah, that's something that Matt Slater covers in his interview very well, that that potential magic trick that may have been pulled on us by the those 12 clubs. But before we get to that interview, Kieran, guess what? There are some other news stories. So, dear listener, consider this a brief, refreshing sorbet before we dive back into the world of the Super League. Firstly, Kieran, Birmingham City's latest accounts had some interesting numbers.
Yeah, Birmingham City's finances are a mess. We know that the club has recently sold the stadium, or rather the owners of the stadium have sold the stadium to somebody else, and this is all going through offshore companies. Why did Birmingham sell the stadium in 2019 to begin with? It's because they were in danger of breaching financial fair play, because that year they lost nearly 30 million quid and the sale of the stadium reduced those losses. What have they done in 2020? Well, they've nearly lost another 30 million quid. So, you know, it's a slight reduction. And you can certainly see why they ended up selling Jude Bellingham. You know, clearly they managed to unearth a fantastic talent. But looking at these numbers, that they didn't have a choice in the matter, because you know, they lost 28.8 million pounds on a day-to-day basis, and they managed to sell him shortly after the year end to try to shore up the finances. But they do look a bit of a mess of a club, because it's one thing to lose 30 million quid when you're chasing promotion, but 30 million quid when you're trying to fight off relegation to League One, that's an awful lot of money clearly not being spent wisely by the club.
Ipswich Town have repaid a number of outstanding loans.
Yes, the new owners of Ipswich Town, who are called Game Changer 20, and I think we're going to try and get them on the show, because it'll be interesting to get their perception, because this is, as we know, the Arizona State Pension Fund are involved in this one.
Yes, they're booked. I believe they're booked.
Booked.
Yes, I, as a matter of principle, I read one out of every three emails that producer guy sends, and the one I happen to catch clearly implies that they are indeed booked, because, of course, he's taking all the credit for it, although I believe it was you who made the phone call, but carry on.
Ipswich had a lot of debt, which was due to the former owner, Marcus Evans, and what the new guys appear to have come in and done is that they've put in around about 18 or 19 million pounds in cash. I suspect that that money will be used to pay back Marcus Evans some of his loans, and the stories that are coming out is that he's going to, you know, they're going to pay him about 20 million pounds of his loans, and the other 70 or 80 he's just going to walk away into the sunset and say, well, it was an exciting adventure while it lasted. He still retains 5% of Ipswich Town. You know, I think he's hoping at one point in time that they will return to the Premier League. And I'm sure Game Changer 20 and, of course, all Ipswich Town fans will hope that as well, because we have a system of promotion and relegation in this country which gives you hope, unlike a certain other competition.
That retaining the 5%, Kieran, is that a kind of token way of staying in touch with the club, or is that a genuine hope that he will make money on that 5%? He'll get a return on his dividend.
Yes, I think it's sort of it's a bit like putting a bet on the National on a 33-1. Okay. You're not expecting it, but yeah, it's not going to cost you a lot of money. And let's, you know, you like the name of the horse, or you like the silks, or your granddaughter ticked it off on a list.
Yeah, and Rangers have issued a bundle of new shares.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, Or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Yes, Rangers have been making share issues on a regular basis over the last 12 months, and trying to get the exact details has been a bit confusing. Rangers, they're champions of the SPFL, and deservedly so, because they played the best football, and that's something which is good. It's nice to see rewards for clubs that actually play the best football, as opposed to an invitation only tournament. Yep. The club is losing money, and therefore it does need financial assistance. Looking at the every sort of 6 to 8 weeks, we're seeing more shares being issued. Sometimes it's the existing lenders, who tend to be Rangers fans, saying, "You owe us a load of money. Tell you what, don't repay us. Give us shares instead." But this most recent one, I think this is it's Club 1872. Who are a fan group who are trying to buy 25% of the club from the former chairman, Dave King. And they're going through various fundraising routines and trying to get fans to commit to pay a monthly amount, and they can use this to buy more and more shares. I just welcome them. I wish them all the best in this. It's a lot of money they've got to raise, but they do seem very committed. They do seem very organized. Whether they'll achieve it or not, time will only tell. And if it takes them a little bit longer than they originally anticipated, I fervently hope that Dave King does the right thing and says, "I'll give you a bit more time, lads."
Mm. Do you know what, Kieran? I never went on a Club 1830 holiday, but I'm reached the age where I would consider a Club 1872.
Oh, Wayne Rooney likes those as well.
He does it. So you've done it again. You've made me laugh with my hay fever. Yes, I do get hay fever at night, everybody. The pollen falls off the trees at night. And Southampton have signed a new kit deal with Hummel.
Yeah, well, this looks really good. I can recall, I'm sure you can, some of the Hummel kits from yesteryear. And because they've signed a new kit deal with them, they're bringing out some of the old kits, or as Perez would say of Real Madrid, legacy kits. Because the one thing which really hacked me off, and if you want proof that the people in charge of this project have no concept of football, to refer to anybody that's been watching football for 10, 20, 30, 40, or in our case, 50 plus years, as legacy fans, and that the football should be focusing on new fans, is one way to completely alienate any sliver. And we are talking slivers of thinking, well, yeah, perhaps these guys do have a point, and there are some benefits to this tournament. No, we are the people that they want to eliminate from the game, because they want to replace us, who turn up to the ground at 5 to 3 and leave straight afterwards, and don't buy anything in the merchandise stalls week in, week out, and don't buy the food at those grounds where the food's appalling, because we know which grounds are. They want to replace us with tourists and day trippers, because they're more lucrative.
Yeah, and the thing is as well, that he's managed to alienate the young fans as well, that he's trying to attract by saying that their attention spans are too short for 90 minutes of football. Kieran, The Athletic has quickly established itself in the UK as a place for serious, reliable football reporting, and some funny stuff too. And we asked one of their top journalists to join us for a chat about what? I don't know. Matt, thank you so much for joining us. I'm not going to lie, Matt. I genuinely can't remember what we were going to talk about before this all kicked off. If you were here to promote a new charity, I can only apologise. Or Southend, again, I can only apologise. I know
we're a charity. Southend's a charity.
A friend of mine is a very hangdog actor. He's a Southend fan, and he's not acting the hangdog now. His face just gets longer and longer. He looks like Droopy off the cartoons at the moment. Matt, The Athletic is one of the world's most renowned sources of football news and journalism. When did you first become aware the European Super League was going to happen and it was going to happen now?
Oh, well, there's a lot in that question to unpack. That's very nice of you to say that about The Athletic.
You're welcome. They sponsor my Palace pod, so I feel I have to. Yeah,
we're all on the pay. When did I think it would happen? Well, did it happen, Kevin?
Well, did it happen? Let's make it more simple then, Matt. Were you expecting that announcement before it happened this weekend?
Right, I'll be honest. So, yes and no, and here's why. I was aware of a lot of what was announced on Sunday a couple weeks ago.
Right,
and I was aware of nearly everything about a week before. Right, but hands up, time. I didn't believe it.
Oh,
or I didn't believe that they would do it. And the reason I didn't believe they would do it is because I thought this was another version of the same story for the last 30-odd years. Right. That this is the big scary weapon, the nuclear option that you have there. It's over there, but you never use it. My God, don't use it. Don't press that button. Make them think you might press it, but don't do that. Because you know what? Every time we threaten to use that weapon, good stuff happens.
Yeah.
And it's worked again and again and again. And you just got to kind of look like you mean it. Obviously, you know, don't go through it half-hearted, lads, right? But make a website. Yeah, hire a PR firm. Let them know that we've got an office in Millbank. Attend meetings and then maybe sort of go, we'll come back to you tomorrow. Look credible, chaps. But I didn't think they'd do it. And I actually went on holiday last week and I sort of wrote a briefing note to my team saying, look, the last chance for this, for them to play this card is in the Sunday papers. Just keep your eyes on the ball, but don't go mad. It's all going to be fine. They've already got the Swiss model, which I'm sure we'll discuss a bit more. I mean, you've probably already done 18 gags on the Swiss model already. Yep. The real news will happen next week when it's all kind of way through and we can have a great big debate about the coefficient backdoor and, you know, 180-odd games to eliminate 12 teams and all that wonderful stuff and this joint venture and giving them a bigger say on the commercial rights and get into all of that, right? Because they're not going to do the Super League.
Yeah.
And then they did it.
I'm kind of glad you said that because you've answered one of my other questions already, which was, did you think it was a giant negotiation tool? Then, of course, I realised that Kieran once referred to Ed Woodward as a giant negotiation tool.
very good.
When did you first become aware then that it was going to collapse? And can you narrow that down to the hour?
All right. Good. When it would? It was around yesterday afternoon. So we're talking at sort of coming up to lunchtime on Wednesday. So much has happened in the last 48 hours. I have to sort of unscramble my brain a bit. I had on Monday, as we were kind of, oh my God, they actually did it. And then loads of conversations with people, administrators, club execs, bloody hell, they did it, right? Yeah. Did they do it on purpose? Have we all massively misread it? Did they do it by accident? Is it like some sort of Cold War drama where, oh my God, we've pressed the button. It's all over. or have we all been massively played? Or are these guys like playing 3D chess and, you know, we're just not clever enough to work out what they're doing? You know, is this the NFL? Have we just completely misunderstood? Have we let these Americans in? And have they just been attending our meetings and talking about promotion and relegation and the pyramid whilst they built the NFL quietly in the background? You know, no one knew, right? But the more we talked and the more I listened, it became clear there were massive holes, massive problems in the Super League business model. The borrowed money from JP Morgan, the lack of a broadcast partner, the fact that they had only three countries in there, only seven cities. They didn't really explain the mechanism for it not to be a closed shop. If it was going to be a closed shop, they wouldn't get FIFA approval. If they didn't have FIFA approval, they were basically playing illegal games. The police wouldn't turn up. The governments around the country, not just ours, were saying, we might legislate. It just, the holes in the problem, the holes in the plan, sorry, just became more apparent. You were thinking, well, they've got the sort of PR half right in that they coordinated their statement and they've got a website. But where's the day two plan? Where are the front men of this going, yeah, we're going to take you on in the courts. Yeah, sorry, fans, don't worry about it. We're thinking of you. Trust me, it's going to be amazing. Come with us. Here's our broadcast partner. It's going to be incredible. It's going to be the Netflix of football. Where was all this? And the longer it went on, the longer it went into Tuesday, and I started to see UEFA aren't going to back down. They've just gone ahead and announced their Champions League reforms. They've done the deal with the 240 clubs that have been left behind in the European Club Association, you know, the rest of the leading clubs in Europe. And the Premier League, the 14, are up for the fight. They're not going, oh, no, what do you want? Come back. We can't live without you. They're like, sod you. We're going to, we'll bring a couple of good teams up from the Championship. We might even invite the old firm down. Doesn't matter. To be discussed. We're not going to cave in. Now, more and more, I started to think they've got this wrong. They've got this wrong. And then there was this, the big narrative yesterday was that some of the English clubs, and it was quite interesting to hear Alexander Seferin, the president of UEFA, in his Congress, specifically in his speech at Congress, specifically talk about English clubs. Come on, gentlemen, we all make mistakes. Yeah. Da, 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 da. They knew there were waverers, the last ones in, City, Chelsea in particular, and the behind-the-scenes lobbying of City and Chelsea was just aggressive yesterday. Yeah. So by the evening, late afternoon, it was just, I was just thinking, who's first? You know, I thought it'd be City, ended up being Chelsea, although they're arguing about it now in typical football fashion. And then I was quite surprised, actually, how quickly, I mean, you know, I thought it might take the rest of this week, but my word, you know, here we are, well, 13, 14 hours later, and there's only, what, three or four of them left? None of the English clubs are there. So the speed of the unraveling surprised me. But by yesterday afternoon, I knew that one or two of them were going.
Matt, they've not only unraveled quickly, they've unraveled abjectly. I mean, Tottenham and Arsenal's apologies were almost risible. But were they? What I don't understand about this, Matt, I mean, essentially this was a replacement for the Champions League. They're talking about a European Super League to take place at the same time as a domestic league. Do you think they were unprepared for the level of domestic opposition to what is essentially a new European league?
Yes, right. Absolutely unprepared. And that then we can get into the whole conversations about their arrogance, how detached they are, the fact that they're absent, that they could misread the room that badly.
Yeah.
But look, the European Super League, by the way, you notice they didn't call it European. It was Super League.
That's
right?
Super League, yeah.
This was meant to be franchised. This was going to be a series of Super Leagues, regional Super Leagues, that all fed into a FIFA-approved Club World Cup, right? This was going to be 100 leading teams around the globe, okay, all feeding in. This was the brave new world, right? The MLS on a global scale. So, no, it did not. The point was that they weren't a breakaway and they weren't closed.
Yeah.
So that was why they had to have those five in there. And that not breaking away was, we're not breaking away from our domestic leagues. We're still part of our pyramid, if you like. We are only just choosing not to go into UEFA's Champions League.
Yeah.
Now, when it became clear to me and others that the Premier League were like, no, you cannot play in a European Super League and play in the Premier League for umpteen reasons. And the main reasons are because you are just destroying our business model. When we go to the market to broadcasters and sponsors, we are selling that we are, that it's merit, that it's this sort of any given Sunday idea you often hear in the States.
Yeah.
The Europe is a prize that you earn. The race for European places. You know, we have jeopardy in our league at the bottom. You'll get relegated. You know, if you're a Leicester, an Everton, or West Ham, you could reach Europe. You know, it's not given to Arsenal, Spurs, Liverpool that you will, you know, qualify for this 100 million euro prize every year. That's what brings the drama. That's what has added to the value of these undisputably big, successful, powerful brands. But some of that, I would argue, a lot of that allure has come from the competitions they're in. Yeah. So you go off and go to a closed league, well, you're damaging us. You are hurting us. When we go to broadcasters this summer and say, yeah, can we have £3 billion again? No, you can't, because not only have you just put, you know, you've just seen your six teams go off over there. Are they going to play B teams in your league?
Yeah.
You've certainly killed the race for Europe. So that, I think, was their biggest tactical mistake, their biggest error, that they didn't seem to properly think through that they could carry on playing at home.
Yeah. Now, are we really to believe that Man City and Chelsea were reluctant partners in this, as they're implying? I mean, these negotiations must have been happening for months, and they're giving the impression that they kind of went along with it because they didn't want to be left behind. That can't be so, surely.
All right. Well, I mean, I think there are times when you do this job where you almost just have to let people make up their own minds, right?
Yeah.
Okay. We're all adults here, most of us, I think. Anyway. All I can tell you is that is the sort of the consistent briefing from their side. And it is kind of corroborated by others in that there were ringleaders here. Look, go back to school playground, right? There's some naughtiness over there, right? Something bad's happened. There are the weak that kind of get swept along, that aren't brave enough to walk away because I might miss something, or people will laugh at me if I walk away from this thing. There are the ringleaders. Look, when it all goes off and goes wrong, how do you separate and differentiate that? You know, do you punish them all equally? I don't know. We will find out. But I think it is fair to say certainly City and I think Chelsea were the more reluctant, I don't know, reluctant might be the wrong word. They were sort of more passive.
Right.
I'm led to believe that City had sort of attended these things, hadn't said anything, hadn't contributed, very much took the view that we can't miss out. We have American and Chinese investors. If this amazing, cool thing is going to happen, we've got to be part of it, right? They haven't got a wonderful relationship with UEFA, as we know. You know, they sort of thought, well, look, we need to be part of this, I think. I think Chelsea, similar. Look, Abramovich calls the tune there. Everybody knows. I think he's semi-engaged. I think he loves the club. I don't think he was all over this, to be honest. I think it was sort of like, yeah, kind of tag along, go along to those meetings, keep me posted. And this is where I come back to this idea that they press the button by accident, some of these guys. I think for Real Madrid, who have been at the center of every single one of these conspiracies for about the last decade, particularly Florentino Perez, it was very real, still is real. They have outgrown La Liga, they feel. The briefing I'm hearing is that they feel that the Big Six, the Premier League and Qatar, have knifed the European Super League. They're not backing down. That's how they feel. They feel indignant about this.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Perez, because he's the one who's been most defiant. And he's the one who actually came up with a public reason, which I'm still laughing at, to save football, because young people were being driven away by low-quality games. And this bit went really under the radar. He also said that games in the Super League would probably be shorter to keep the attention of young fans. I mean, that's when you start laughing. That's when it becomes kind of Bond supervillain stuff, totally out of the realms of reality, doesn't it?
Well, also this sense that he's kind of making it up as he goes along.
Yeah.
Have all these plans been properly discussed? Look, in amongst all that, and the other kind of main guy here is Andrea Agnelli, who owns Juventus and was previously a UEFA vice president and certainly on the Exco. And he was he ran the European Club Association, this big, very important group of leading clubs. You know, the snake in chief, to be honest, certainly in terms of UEFA, you know, he was supposed to make a joint statement with UEFA's president on Saturday. He turned his phone off. Look, in amongst what he's saying there is the kind of thing they're saying amongst each other all the time, of these clubs, right? What do we do about the game? You know, we're CEOs. They could be CEOs of any company, right? We have a responsibility to think about the future. That's why we get the big bucks. We've got to think strategically. So, you know, are kids watching 90 minutes? No, my kids aren't. How are they consuming sport? On their phones, on their devices, on their games and all that. You know, how they have got into football is very different to how I got into football. Mm. Right. So we got to be aware of that, right? Where's our growth? We're big companies now. We have these massive brands, but we're not valued in the same way that North American sports franchises are valued, or fly by night tech stocks. You know, we've been around for 100-odd years. Why aren't we given the love when we go to the market? Why don't the big banks treat us in the same way they treat, you know, Amazon? You know, not Amazon, but whatever the latest buzzy thing is, right? So these are the things they worry about. So when he says off the top of his head, well, does it need to be 90 minutes? Well, you know, that's an interesting debate. Should we have that debate? Should we all have that debate? Should we think about how we maybe package and present football? You know, it's very interesting that the NFL recently has started to do things that are very sort of, they did some of their games on Nickelodeon.
Yeah.
So a rights holder would have the same game, but would have different streams giving different treatment. So one, for example, idea is you'd have a very kind of stats heavy, almost kind of like, you know, scout techie. The people that love kind of, you know, expected goals and all that. You could do that kind of treatment of a game. Yeah. But then you could also do a very betting, gambling heavy one. You could do one that's pitched at youngsters, that's kind of like YouTubers. And there's all sorts of things you could do. So these are all the conversations they're having all the time. And that, I think, is what is underpinning some of this angst around where the game is going. They're looking at the average age of subscribers. They're looking at the average age of people in the grounds. And they're thinking, look, we would be failing our responsibilities if we preside over the very, very gradual decline of our sport.
Mm.
So I'm slightly playing devil's advocate, and I have no problem with them doing that. But then look what they've actually done. Mm. They've done it. Their solution to that was to set up a closed shop.
I liked I like Barcelona dealing their own get out card this morning by saying, well, it was always subject to the approval of our season ticket holders anyway. But domestically, Matt, Ed Woodward, executive vice chair of Manchester United, was the first high-profile casualty. Now, Man United are spinning that he was due to leave anyway, but to use the technical term, that's bollocks, isn't it? He's gone because of this, hasn't he?
Well, he's certainly gone because of this, like now. I mean, I have heard they're certainly briefing heavily that he was going to go at some point. He was thinking about going in the summer. Right, fine. Okay. Well, we will never know, shall we, right? Because he certainly wasn't going to go last night with his tail between his legs and a big slap bum. You know, I wonder who's next. And it can't just be him. Because just from a sort of human point of view, let's just sort of have a little think about what's been going on for the last few weeks and months. Just first of all, in Europe. So as I say, there's been this very two-year, carefully choreographed, quite tortuous at times, debate around how to change the Champions League. And I've got no problem with changing things and freshening things up and all that. And we can have an argument whether we like the Swiss model and how we think about those coefficient places. I don't like them either. But certainly I have no problem with formats being tweaked to keep them, you know, interesting. So that's been going for 2 years. These people have been in those meetings. They have nodded, agreed, you know, aye and all that. As of right up until this weekend, they've been party. They've heard secrets, confidential, commercially sensitive stuff. At the same time, while plotting a rival organization that will, frankly, shit all over the Champions League, right? Yeah. That will still broadcast money, eyeballs, commercial sponsors, the lot, right? At the same time, so they've sat in meetings, been given, you know, like, as I say, commercially sensitive information and said nothing. The same thing has been going on in the Premier League. So there's been this strategic review off the back of Project Big Picture. They've certainly been attending and listening to meetings about what we're going to do with our broadcast rights. You know, we're going to postpone the auction. We're going to do it this summer. They've sat there and these are the most important clubs, right? So things haven't been kept from them. And yet they've been riding these two horses. Now, there are genuine moves and calls, and they're growing, that these guys have breached their responsibilities to these other organizations.
Yeah.
They have very probably failed the owners and directors test, quite frankly, because you have a responsibility to behave in good faith. There's a legal phrase, I know you like your legal talk, tortious interference. It's basically dealing in bad faith.
Yeah.
So I now think we have the executives of our six biggest clubs who have to be replaced. And then the next step is, do those with significant control have to be replaced?
Yeah.
Do they have to sell? And I think is perhaps to be discussed and to be, we will see, but there is no way those guys, and it is mostly guys, can go back into those rooms, just from a human point of view, because they've just spent a couple of weeks, 3 months, whatever, 2 years lying to these people. But they have also very probably broken the rules of those competitions.
Yeah, I'm aware that this is already becoming the longest pod we've ever done, Matt. So I don't want to get into too much detail, but watching Steve Parish on Newsnight the other night, and I've seen Steve Parish cross before, mainly about things I've said to him, but I've never seen him as angry as I saw him the other night. And he clearly implying that he was looking forward very much to the first time the Premier League chairman all met together in the same place again. But Jose Mourinho went as well. Is there any truth in this story that he was sacked because of his opposition to this?
No, I don't think so. No. Right. I mean, I've heard the same rumor, and you know, as you and everybody else, I don't really have any like great intel there. I find that hard to believe. I think things were going sufficiently wrong elsewhere for him to be sacked. And you know, we've seen other managers, you know, pretty much make their feelings really clear. Jurgen Klopp, Pep Guardiola. So I don't think Saint Jose has sort of fallen on his sword in a noble fashion.
Yeah, although he's not denying it in true Jose style. Matt, these are not words I thought I'd ever use about Oliver Dowden, who's the Minister for Sport and Culture, right. But he did all right, didn't he? Why do you think the government waded in so strongly? Do you think they just spotted voter potential amongst angry fans?
I do, and I'm aware that there's a risk of sounding ludicrously cynical. I just... Politicians and football, it's not great, the track record, in terms of when they get interested, how long they stay interested, and then what they actually do as opposed to say. So, look, I think they saw a bandwagon. It was a righteous bandwagon, and they jumped on it, and they took part. And they said exactly what the rest of football needed them to say, and fair play, they said it. What was it that Boris Johnson was threatening to explode? A legislative bomb? Well, we'll never have to know what that is, I hope.
It's very difficult to predict what part of Boris Johnson would explode at any given time, to be perfectly honest.
Look, they did and said what they did. It did, I think, have an impact. I think the idea that government would make this really, really hard. And there were some potential levers that government could pull. Just really simple ones that I didn't even have a chance to write because there was so much going on. Just from a policing point of view, if these games weren't sanctioned games, the police wouldn't turn up.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Yeah. Matt, a final question. UEFA were very quick to threaten sanctions. Do you think there may still be consequences for the clubs concerned? Because as you tweeted this morning, out of the new Champions League model, these clubs actually do quite well out of it, don't they?
Oh, well, look, here we go. this is where we get into that thing I was saying. Was this just 3D chess? Have we just been massively played?
Yeah.
Was this the greatest magic trick of all time? Because let's just remember what they've got. They've got a 36-team Champions League. They've got extra games. They're probably going to get this sort of joint venture or a more meaningful joint venture, which means a bigger say of the commercial rights. I'm pretty sure that UEFA have been negotiating with private equity firms to give them a great big cash injection that they want post-COVID. And they've got these coefficient places for, you know, your Liverpools and whoever that have that come fifth, sixth or seventh, you know, another way back in. So that looks like a pretty sweet prize for such treachery, doesn't it?
It does.
And I look, and UEFA, the messaging from UEFA is that they are in no mood to make colossal examples of these people. The individuals, maybe. I think we should be worried about Andrea Agnelli's whereabouts. I'd be worried, frankly, because Alexander Seferin is nails. black belt in karate. He's you know, he's an ex-soldier. For his holidays, he has driven across the Sahara 5 times, once on a motorbike.
So I'm just worried. I'm just thinking back to Kieran. Have you been criticising Alexander Seferin yet?
No, me, big busy me.
Good, Matt. It's been brilliant to talk to you. It really has. We could talk for much longer. Before we go, did you have anything else you wanted to talk about?
No, well, I mean, we could do Southend, but is there any point? Is there any point to Southend United?
I've got a soft spot for Southend. They're one of the clubs I particularly like, apart from the fact that my dear friend Martin supports them. But I always remember one afternoon, it was an away game in the League Cup, when we were sitting outside a pub near the sea, and this Southend fan came up and started chatting, and he made us laugh so much with a terrible joke when he said, you know how they call our ground Roots Hall? They should call it Fuck Hall. which we thought was hilarious, but then cut to me getting home that night about 12:30, waking up my wife to tell her this brilliant joke that I'd heard by this Southend fan. But also during that game, and it's still one of my favourite moments in any football ground ever, it was packed. It was a League Cup game. And just after half time, the PA announcer said, Terry Thomas from Croydon, please make his way back home because his wife has gone into labour. And the whole ground burst into spontaneous applause. And as he stood up to leave, the whole ground spontaneously started to sing Part-Time Supporter. And he started gesticulating, and then he sat down again, and he could see his two mates going, leave the ground. And he refused to leave because he didn't want to be called a part-time supporter. But so Southend are a club I've always liked, and it pains me to see them in this situation because he's one of those owners. You can't, every now and again, he'll say something, and you think, he's all right, this bloke, and then the rest of the time you think, no, he's just running his club into the ground, isn't he? And it's a club that, well, and again, because Essex football is struggling enough as it is, and you've got Southend and Colchester,
taking on Redbridge
in the same situation, and these are areas that it's always astonishing. I mean, you can understand why, but these are areas where fans shouldn't be travelling from Essex to Tottenham. They should be, they've got Southend and Colchester. Clubs with big traditional histories on them. We weren't supposed to be talking about Southend, Matt. I'll let you go.
You're making me cry.
Sorry, mate.
But for the record, Southend left the league before Chelsea or City.
Matt, it's been brilliant to talk to you. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thanks, Matt.
Okay, guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Matt. Kieran, that was... I mean, there was some really interesting insight there, Kieran, and we haven't got time to unpick it all, but one thing I noticed there, and it's quite near the end of Matt's conversation, is when he talked about UEFA taking out a private equity loan to distribute to the bigger clubs. Did I pick it up on that correctly?
Yes, it looks as if UEFA are in talks, and they're talking about effectively a something like around about a $6 billion rescue package, because it looks like some of the individual clubs are struggling to satisfy the lenders and who are a bit cautious. So UEFA is going to act as a sort of a central hub and then distribute that money to try to dig these clubs up. So it's evidence that in politics and football, you can be calling somebody a snake one day And, you know, 3 or 4 hours later, you're lending the money. UEFA is saying, actually, you know, we are going to look after as many clubs as we can in Europe, including these ones. Mm. Yes, we're not happy with what's happened recently, but ultimately, we're all in the same game and let's move forwards. Now, what the reaction and whether there'll be any humility shown from Perez and Agnelli and people of that nature, time will only tell.
Yeah, it is, well, there won't be, I suspect. But I mean, it's such a shame, Kieran. These are clubs that, you know, you talked about the romance of football earlier and why we supported football and when we supported football as kids. I mean, these were clubs that you wanted to support, you know. You wanted Juventus, you wanted Real Madrid. These are clubs that we grew up watching on telly, the great European nights, you know, Liverpool included. And it's just such a shame to see them tarnishing their image in this tawdry chase for money. It's
not the clubs, it's the owners. I cannot stress this enough.
Yeah,
but because it was the Liverpool fans and the Chelsea fans
who
didn't have to go out in the last couple of nights because they were going to be financially winning. It's the fans who said, no, you do not reflect my love of Chelsea, my love of Liverpool, my love of Manchester United. Get out of my club. Get out of my game, in effect. And, you know, Gary Neville expressed that far more articulately and far more passionately than I did. But it was great to listen to.
No, you've calmed me down now, Kieran. You're like a parent with a toddler. I'm fine now. That's why this pod works so well, Kieran, because I'm a lovable idiot and you're lovable and clever.
150 episodes.
Yes, I'm not going to pretend I knew that, Kieran. So, but I saw your tweet, which is how I often get my news about the pod. Yes, I'm amazed. As you said, we continue to be the sand in the Vaseline, and I can't stress enough how much I agree with you, Kieran. Both of us gave it 2 weeks, essentially.
Yes.
Both of us.
That's why I never told you I was a Brighton fan. I thought, why upset him? We'll just walk away like ships in the night.
Well, also, I mean, Guy just seemed such an optimistic little puppy, didn't he? And he was, remember, we first met in Soho and he was all wide-eyed and innocent and walking around going, oh, did the craze walk around here? And bless him, not in that accent, of course, so no way we talk like Orville the Duck. But anyway, Kieran, I'm super leagued out, so let's reconvene on Monday for our questions pod. If you have any questions at all on any aspect of the Super League or of football finance in general, then email us on questions@priceoffootball.com. And as ever, I shall leave you in the capable hands of Mr. Kieran Maguire to say goodbye on the occasion of our 150th episode.
Well, thanks for taking us to this this landmark, listeners, because it's only with your support that we keep on going, because you keep us on our toes, and you know, we appreciate your support, and you know, we do try to represent the views of fans, and that's where our angle is from. I know this is a business podcast, but this is a business podcast by fans for fans. If you like the show, press that purple button on your Apple app or your Spotify app. If you could give us a review, we'd be most grateful. If you can make it 5 stars, it helps us in the charts. And we are trying to get good quality guests all the time to give us a greater insight. I mean, Matt Slater, I'm not saying he's the only reason I subscribe to The Athletic, but he is certainly the number one. His writing is absolutely magnificent. So to persuade people who are connected to the industry to come in, because they look at the charts and they say, if we were number 727 in the football charts, and they say, thanks, lads, but no thanks. Apart from that, good luck. God bless. Well done for Chelsea fans and Liverpool fans and Manchester United fans and all fans who have stood up to these people over the course of the last 40 hours.
Hear, hear. The price of football. Price of football.